Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbun, and I'm coming to you from Sydney, Australia, where I'm a senior lecturer at Macquarie University. And I have the pleasure today to be speaking with Natalia Melman-Petrozella, who is an associate professor of history at the New School, and also the author of a couple of fantastic books. The first is Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture, which is out with Oxford University Press in 2015. But we're here today to talk about Natalia's most recent book, Fit Nation, The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession, which is out with University of Chicago Press in 2022, right?
It came out technically 2022, but it didn't ship or release until January 23.
But most excitingly, is going to paperback this year. I mean, that's amazing.
I'm really excited.
Yeah. So pick up copy right now and pick up a paperback too.
Yes, please do. Audiobook too.
Thanks so much for joining me, Natalia.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I have to say, I love this book. It was just, I actually read sections out loud to my wife, which I don't do for most of the books that I read.
What? That's the first time I've heard that. And that's amazing.
My wife is a big bar. She goes to bar probably four times a week. And so we got to talking about bar because of this, and we were reading out loud and laughing and kind of, you know, discussing how the vibes have changed or not changed. But
I love that. Couples reading. Perfect date night, read aloud.
Well, I think we're laughing more because we know the context, but maybe we shouldn't go too much into that.
You'll only know if you read, listeners.
That's right. Natalia, could you tell me a little bit more about how you developed this project? You write about it in the beginning, and it's pretty compelling. So I wonder if you can tell us a bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I'm a historian of modern United States, and my first book was about the 60s and 70s in California. So in some ways, it's like, oh, it makes perfect sense in the intellectual trajectory to turn next to fitness and wellness cultures, because the 60s and 70s were such an important moment for that, and California was such an important site for that. So that's definitely there. But there's a much deeper personal story, which is that growing up, I was always like really intimidated by any pursuit of the body, whether it was fitness or actually didn't really know what fitness was, but like PE class or sports or dance. This was like in the 1990s when I was in high school. And I was so mortified by PE class that I got a kind of path to do an independent study in phys ed, which just meant something supervised. And so I found my way to a step aerobics class in the Jewish Community Center where I lived. And I was really just thinking anything would be better than phys ed, but this I loved, like moving together, the music, feeling myself getting stronger. It was challenging, but I could do it. It like everything about it, like awakened something inside of me. And I'm like, what is this world? It's not sport. It's not really dance, but like, what is it? And that was just my curiosity as a 16-year-old. So I went on to kind of, you know, I was very academic and like made my way to be a historian, but I had this kind of like second life as a gym rat. I was working at gyms, teaching fitness, et cetera. And I realized that this, what is this feeling, actually had a sort of scholarly counterpart, which was that scholars hadn't actually thought seriously about what the gym is in American life. And so I turned to that. And that was the project that preoccupied me for almost a decade and became Fit Nation.
That's I loved this because I actually spent a lot of time at the JCC myself when I was a kid.
Yay! All roads lead to the JCC.
But doing anything fit. I was more sporty, baseball and basketball. But that's funny. I love this book. One of the things I really loved about this book was that you chase out these tensions that never seem to really disappear between what is fitness versus what's sport. Can fitness be liberatory, or is it about stratification and restriction? Was this driven by the public or the private? Is it about health and wellness, or is it about something else entirely? So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, beyond just the idea that there's a gap in the literature and a lot of scholars don't take physical culture seriously. What were some of the broader goals of the project? Like, what surprised you, and what's the big takeaway you want people to have?
Sure. So, in terms of the broader goals of the project, my kind of animating question, I always describe this moment. I was at a conference. It was American Studies in Los Angeles, and I went for a walk in LA, which you should never do because you end up on a freeway, like I always do. And I looked up over the freeway. No cars hit me, thank goodness. And I saw this gym, and there were all of these people like running on a treadmill at like 7 o'clock at night or something. And I remember thinking, like, this is crazy. Some visitor from another planet would look at this and be like, there are all these people who are like running really fast and really hard and not spending time with their family and not looking like they're having fun and spending money to do this. And like, what is this? Right. So I started to kind of think about it in that kind of like broad sense, like almost ethnographically, of like, what is this space and like what animates people to participate in it? But then really the thing that kind of got me going was what I might think of as a paradox, which is this notion that in the United States, which is so divided by politics and polarization of various sorts, pretty much everyone agrees exercise is good for you and even believes like exercise makes you a good person. And at the same time, less than a third of Americans exercise the recommended daily amount. And so that those two issues or dynamics or questions really pushed me to first explore as a historian, well, how did we get here to this consensus that regular exercise is good for you? And I started in a moment when that was absolutely not the consensus and tracked that over time. But also, if we do agree that it's so good for you, why do so few people do it? And I don't know, you want the spoiler of like kind of me answering that, or should we save
that? Yeah, no, well, no. I mean, I should say for readers, Natalia spools this out like very comprehensively, but extremely readably in seven sections. I encourage people to read it because I mean, actually, it's really compelling. You get to follow these characters. Some of them quite. I mean, Jack LaLanne, you're following through a very large part of the book. Give listeners the spoiler, like, you know.
Yeah. So the basic idea is that we started a moment. I started in 1893 when I say sweating was strange. Like if you were someone who wanted to work on your muscles or go to the gym regularly, whether you were a man or a woman for different reasons, like that was suspicious behavior. It was seen as if you're a guy, like weirdly effeminate. Why do you care what your body looks like? Why do you want to hang out with all these sweaty dudes? Why are you focusing on the physical rather than the cerebral? Shouldn't you be playing sports if you're doing something physical? And for women, the idea was like, you know, sweating and building muscles is totally unfeminine. It makes you look masculine. It can damage your uterus and your fertility. And it's just sort of unseemly. And so you've had these really strong kind of cultural barriers to participating in fitness cultures at that time. And so basically the story that I tell is how fitness went from being this strange subculture, which I attribute largely to it being seen as a very narrow physical pursuit, to being kind of perceived as an integral part of the good life. And so the story that I tell throughout, you know, the long 20th century, let's say, is that this narrowly physical activity gets attached to a whole range of much broader purposes. First, you have kind of like fitness as civic commitment, and that's like JFK and Eisenhower. And then you have like fitness as liberatory and like bodily self-reclamation. And that's the Panthers and these feminists who are like throwing off ideas about female frailty or about, you know, Black lack of self-bodily knowledge. Then you also have like conservatives who are like, yes, you know, who needs healthcare and welfare? Just get out, unlike these permissive hippies, and do something hard, go running, like discipline and all of that. This evolves over time. A consumer capitalist economy really seizes this and runs with it, but combined with a kind of intellectual shift where the notion of mind-body holism, which today is a totally trite cliche, but absolutely did not exist in the United States in the 50s, the 60s, even outside of the counterculture in the 1970s, that really goes mainstream. And that is very good for the mainstreaming of fitness culture. This idea that you cannot be a fully actualized person if you're not working on your body. And so that makes it less about like, I'm just working on pumping up my bicep, to like, I'm just, you know, working on myself and being fully actualized. And that is feels loftier and thus is an easier sell and feels kind of more socially important.
Yeah, and sometimes you read books and you feel seen and you're like, not in a good way. Sometimes.
I know. Like, just, yes. Sometimes you write books and you're like, I feel seen and not in
That's
a good
right.
way.
But okay. So Natalia, you've given us kind of the broad scope, and in the interest of time, because I know we have some time issues with myself, really. let's jump right in. We can take as read, I guess, that early moment of Cartesianness, where we're like, oh, sweating is weird. Let's stay at it. So maybe give us, because I think listeners who are from the United States will remember presidential fitness tests. So maybe that's a way to like just draw them right in. Like, why? What is? When does the government really get invested in fitness and investing in fitness and trying to regulate how fitness happens in places?
So, you know, it's kind of like a slow build from the early 20th century. Like, you do have this symbolism of like Teddy Roosevelt, who loves the strenuous life, but it's pretty symbolic. He's not really investing in like physical fitness programs. There is this really important turning point that in a book that some of your listeners will know by Rachel Louise Morant called Governing Bodies. It's so good. And she talks about the way that the New Deal was actually this really important turning point, and that the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, actually, part of the way that it marketed itself was, you know, young men will get this like strong, muscular physique by working for their country. And the promotional materials for this, I mean, they look like gay physique magazines. And you're like, the federal government put this out. But that was really important in kind of like sanitizing that idea of bodily work as being part of civic commitment. And so to get to the physical fitness test, the kind of sea change that happens is in the 50s and 60s with Eisenhower and Kennedy. And really, it's neither of them, but this woman, Bonnie Pruden, who lives in White Plains. She's like this suburban, I'll call her a homemaker because she wasn't working outside the home at this time, but she had a big life before having children. And she noticed that all these kids, she noticed that in her bedroom community, which like, were Americans who kind of had it all. They had TVs and they had cars and leisure and frozen foods and all this. The kids were really out of shape. And she was like, this is actually a problem. And she first thought of it just in terms of like the kids' health. And so she was like running little workout classes at her daughter's schools, et cetera. And she publishes an article about this in this obscure journal. Like very few people read it. No one gets attention. But it's when she connects this to national security and the fact that if young American children and the ones who are supposed to like be enjoying the best of what America has to offer, if they are too unfit to fight, well, then America has a problem. So she gets the ear of the White House under Eisenhower. Eisenhower, you know, former general, is like all into this. He appoints Richard Nixon to the head of the Presidential Council on Youth Fitness. Obvious choice, right? Super fit, yeah. Dick Nixon. Yeah. And they start this PE program to encourage fitness in schools. And what's interesting about that is it's a very significant turning point, but it's like not fun. Like this is very militaristic. It's what you would think. It's military style calisthenics. It's only like targeting the boys. It's very fear-based. Like, oh, we're all going to be too fat. The Russians are going to beat us. Like you better do sit-ups. Like it's not fun. Enter JFK, like perfect poster boy for fitness, right? He's the youngest president ever. Incidentally, of course, he suffered from a lot of health ailments that actually made him quite unwell. But he kind of infuses this fun and lifestyle to fitness. He's like challenging his brother to do 50-mile hikes, and he's in photo shoots, like playing on the beach. And he brings girls into the programs and introduces these fitness programs in schools and really promotes them really hard as being like core to not only being like a good American who's protected the United States from the Cold War, but also core to like being kind of like affluent and aspirational. And like, this is part of like a good American life, not just leisure, but this kind of spending your leisure time in this way. And so you asked earlier on about, or like commented as one of the themes, which you're right, it is the book, the relationship between fitness and sport. What was so interesting in looking at the documents around these programs was this real push-pull between the world of sport and the world of fitness, which was relatively new in terms of like a policy item at this time. And basically what happens is that Kennedy and his fitness boosters are very invested in promoting recreational fitness as something different from and even antithetical to sport. Very surprising to me. So some of the documents that were being like passed around to districts were like, actually, an elite sports program in your school system can be a real liability for our goals because it makes kids think that sport and movement is only for the very talented. And Kennedy would talk about something that he called spectatoritis. Spectatoritis was an affliction that he didn't want to afflict American kids, where they thought their role was on the sidelines. And so they were promoting like the opposite of that. These are games that everyone can get involved in and like different challenges where they're very hierarchical, like military, but different levels. And it was really interesting, though, that he did so much work to distinguish this from sport. But in order to sell it to an American public that was very skeptical of fitness and constantly, by the way, making fun of JFK for this, they called it like his fits of fitness and like thought he was so silly for this stuff. But in order to do it, he has to get some really famous sports figures to stand up next to him and talk about this. So, for example, he hires or appoints Bud Wilkinson, who's this really famous college football coach, to be like, kids, you should be out there being active. Go for a jog with your mother, right? And like, so he has to like, he's both like pushing away sport and trying to add something more inclusive, but also needs the support of widely respected sports figures to promote. So it's just super interesting. And you asked about the Presidential Fitness Challenge. Yes, it absolutely comes out of that. And I should say that's a really good moment to say that there's a lot of like golden age thinking about like, oh, the halcyon days of like the JFK PE programs. And yeah, I'd take those over some of the like nonsense that gets passed off, or there are no PE in schools today. But as many people traumatized by the fitness challenge can tell you, like, they were kind of horrible. You'd be in front of the whole class, like, okay, do the rope climb. Yeah, the rope climb traumatized me. I think that's what sent me to do my independent study. The rope climb, the flexibility test, all of it. Like, yeah. It was very much a performance. And I talked to many people for this book who said it turned them off exercise forever. So let's not, like, let's reinstate something better than that.
Well, I mean, and that's a nice lead into your next chapters. And it makes me think, when you're talking about the way in which this kind of spectator-itis was a concern of JFK's, it was a concern in France at the same time. And I talked with another author. We had spoken before we started recording about Czech Republic. And I talked to an author who wrote about the Spartakiad in the Czech Republic. And these kind of like all these, this was an era of alternative fitness kind of globally, but it always was kind of based on the assumption of a kind of single or maybe a dual subject, like, you know, the male subject, the boy, the female subject, the girl, who are one thing. But as you move on to part two, part three and part four, you actually say, okay, that was a big problem, because the JFK account might have included women, but it was basically just a suburban, more or less wealthy suburban approach, right? And so what?
So this is,
jump in.
I'm like leaping through the Zoom. I'm like, I know something about that. Let me tell you. So it was funny. At the beginning of my work on this book, like the very, very beginning, was the end of the Obama years. And so as I was reading some of this stuff, well, like the obvious echo was like, oh my God, this is like Let's Move and Michelle Obama. And there is something to that. Like, I think that Obama, also another young, you know, apparently very fit president, absolutely took a cue from JFK in promoting fitness. What is so profoundly different is who the target of those programs were. In the 1950s and 60s, as you said, the idea was a kind of middle-class white suburbanite who was enjoying too much leisure, right? Like, there are all of these like public service announcements which talk about like the excesses of push-button luxury, like, you know, remote control TVs or being able to drive places, and that being the problem. By now, or the Obama years, which are now like, you know, at least 10 years behind us. Isn't that crazy? Yeah, like almost 10 years behind us, completely, I guess. The subjects are like poor Black and brown people in cities, right? Like, that's where obesity is concentrated. And those are considered the kind of problematic bodies to focus on. And I think that there are a lot of reasons for that. One of the biggest ones is like a shift in our food system starting in the 1980s, where you have a range of policies that make, you know, cheap fast food like the most, honestly, intelligent option for a lot of poor people to eat, which contributes way more than lack of exercise to obesity. But part of it is also that, you know, the other big story I tell is the rise of an industry. And so there's a massive industry, whether it's private gyms for more adults, but increasingly kids too, or like private sports, such that kids who are more affluent are, you know, not impervious, obviously, to obesity or other reasons not to exercise, but have a lot more options if they can pay for them. But we never got that full-throated, full-scale public investment in parks, pools, recreation centers, et cetera, that I think really could have made a difference in the stark and horrible and economic inequality that's manifested in terms of fitness in this country.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me about these chapters as well is the way in which kind of the site of sport moves as well, away from schools and towards kind of the house as well as private organizations too. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, because in some ways, when I finished your book, I was like, oh, this is actually a history of neoliberalism. So I wonder if you can talk a bit about how, because I think that's another one of the main threads. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that happens too. So fitness gets drawn out of schools and into other places.
Yeah. So first on neoliberalism, because I know you have a very scholarly audience here. Yeah. So one of the things I was trying to do with this book is kind of resist, but also contribute to the literature on neoliberalism, specifically as pertains to fitness. So one of the things that I found really annoying, quite honestly, is that to the extent like people were writing about fitness, it was very quickly dismissed as like another example of neoliberalism, and all this is navel gazing and the kind of internalization of the industrialized clock and like narcissistic, et cetera. And it's usually guys making those arguments. And so I agree with some of those arguments, as you say. I'm telling the story of privatization, which absolutely reflects another dimension of the kind of austerity politics, which are at the heart of the argument that neoliberalism has characterized, you know, recent American history. So I'm absolutely part of that. But what I wanted to express is to say that, like, it's not all that. There is a lot going on in fitness cultures, which within the realm of neoliberalism, like, doesn't overtly resist it, but like, they're important forms of community and solidarity and that are happening within there, but also forms of resistance. Like, I talk about a lot of radical fitness traditions, which resist that. So yeah, I just wanted to add that in there. In terms of where it's moved. Yeah. So to a certain extent, I mean, this book is a book that tells about the fall of the physical education and kind of public fitness policy universe and the rise of the private fitness industry. And that is really sad to me, because there is the first people who are enthusiastic about exercise contributing to a good life are people who want to teach phys ed in public schools. Like, we have a really old profession that does that. Like, you know, along with the other professions, kind of like late 19th century, but this was really robust and there was a lot of expertise there and a commitment to phys ed kind of advancing the goals of the polity and all the rest and being democratically accessible. And really, like, there were a lot of Black women, especially, who came up as PE people. So all of that, I think, is really important. That field is around and like continuing to be what to be really important to all these federal programs that are promoting, you know, physical fitness as part of the Cold War, et cetera, et cetera. So much so that in the late 70s and early 80s, as like the broader kind of fitness industry and enthusiasm is picking up, it's absolutely heartbreaking. You read in these phys ed journals, they're like, this is our moment. Like, you know, the whole country is jogging, they're doing fitness classes. Like, we've been here for 75 years and we have all this expertise. And now phys ed is going to get its moment in the sun and we're going to get funding. It's going to be amazing. That, like, the opposite happened, literally. And what ends up happening, and I have a lot of interviews and also data to bear this out, is that as that private industry boomed, some of like the leading lights, honestly, who were really talented people who wanted to go into it, were horrified that they would end up a gym teacher, as they said. Instead, they were like, I can go teach on cruises and in private gyms and have celebrity clients and make VHS tapes. And trust me, that life is not as glamorous as that sounds. And there's a lot of like precarious labor and all that precarious labor going on there. But to this larger point, phys ed never gets its moment in the sun. This is Reagan's America. It gets chopped away as like a kind of frill in education and really never recovers from that. And it's still a huge issue. Like, you know, as much as we all love exercise and we think it's good and we think it's important, you increasingly see kind of privatized programs being the way that these things are disseminated. And I think that is like so sad and such a missed opportunity. And if, you know, Joe Biden or whoever his successor is calls me up to the White House to ask me to fix it, I would like jump at the chance to work
President's Council of you know, sport fitness nutrition.
I would love that. I love, love, love life goals.
Well, I really take your point earlier, and I would say for listeners, like, one of the things that I think this book does really, really well is actually it doesn't sit in a comfortable spot vis-a-vis fitness. Like, it's not fitness is bad. It's not fitness is good. It's an insider's in some ways account, because you are invested in fitness. I think it's fair to say, right? But also it's a very critical account. So throughout, like, I wish we had a lot of time to talk about it. And we could go through you're talking about Jane Fonda and discuss the liberatory possibilities of of feminist fitness while still saying that it's within a frame in which female fitness is sexualized, right? So it's neither one way or the other, which I think is really, which is really good. It's not like a Gutman, not to badmouth other people, but, you know, account where fitness or sport is a kind of proto-fascistic. It's not like that at all. It's it, your reading is quite different. And I would say, just because we were talking about Reagan, one of the parts that I, one of the sections that kind of comes up repeatedly, but that I really liked, is the ways in which gyms were sites for organization for the gay community, right? And totally. Like, that's so important. So I do, I want to give you some more time to talk about, you know, this kind of resistance fitness as well. And so is for people who haven't read the book, like what are the, like if you want to talk a bit about gay organization, that's fine, but just or yeah. Fitness, that's great too. But yeah. You know, we talked a lot about this, the state, what the state wants, and who are these people who are resisting the state and not trying to work within the state at all?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that gay gym culture is a great example of that, of these sites, which were important places for organization for gay men. And so I take this up at different moments, but, you know, kind of certainly pre-Stonewall, but in the early half of the 20th century, as I mentioned before, there was this kind of homophobic stereotype that if you were a man who went to a fitness space, you must be somehow sexually deviant. Like those were not places where straight men out. And while that was caught up in a lot of homophobic assumptions, there also was some truth to it, because of course this was a moment where if you were a man who was looking to you know, have a romantic relationship with other men, there weren't that many places you could do that publicly, right? Gay bars did not exist, at least legally. And so gyms and physique magazines were actually spaces where men could meet one another under the pretense of like, oh, we're into physical culture. Or in those magazines, it was often, I'm into like classical art, because a lot of the models were, would pose in kind of classical garb, like statues. So there's that. But then I think the part that you were talking about in Reagan's America, it's super interesting what happens where when HIV/AIDS comes on the scene, you have gay gyms, which, you know, in the 70s were more absolutely existed, but were more almost like an extension of nightclubs. Like that continues, but they also become these really important like organizing places and havens for people who are facing enormous homophobia and social trauma outside. And so some of the gyms that I look at, like there's one in Houston that I look at, which I found so interesting. So in the 70s, it was like a mixed environment and it built itself as a gym and it was owned by a gay man and it was welcoming to gay people, but it wasn't such a big deal. You see this big rise in homophobia when HIV/AIDS comes on the scene, and this gym kind of closes ranks and it becomes almost like a community aid space where they're raising money for people who are sick. They're bringing doctors who are giving seminars on like different treatments. They're having like art shows for people in their community. And I find it so interesting how the gym became a space that did all these other things that didn't have much to do with exercise. But also when one of the symptoms of HIV/AIDS was kind of wasting away, having that buff physique that of course you get at the gym was a way to broadcast that you are not sick, right? And so I find that so interesting. And, you know, there's some gentlemen who I quote who are like, I hope they're still alive today, but they were certainly alive in the early 2000s and what I was quoting, who had survived HIV/AIDS. They live in Palm Springs, California, and they were sort of like, not laughing, but like they couldn't believe that this like new sort of like slight physique was like popular among young men, because they're like, for us, the image of health, because we lived through AIDS, is to be like ripped and big and bulging, because that is so much like show that you weren't sick. And that was what we saw as healthy. So I just found that so interesting and so important. And I should also say one thing, there's someone else I quote, Simon Doonan, like famous for a variety of fashion related, you know, media. But I quoted something that he said when he talked about the Sports Connection in Los Angeles. And he talked about how during that period, like not so much the gym as this place that was like, oh, you could come and like get a medical seminar. But he's like, my friends were all dying. This was my escape. Those like phenomenal aerobics classes and the music and the spandex and all of that. That was a place I could just like immerse and be myself. And I got that impression a lot, like far from the sort of like joyless spaces of, you know, pounding it out on the treadmill that we might associate with fitness today, there was a kind of fun to those 1980s gyms that in its sense was, in its own sense, was a kind of form of resistance and liberation too.
Yeah, that could be another kind of tension in your work, the tension between joy and between exertion, let's say. I mean,
and joy and pain, right?
Yeah, joy and pain. Yeah, you see it. You see it. I mean, like, you know, you have a big section on Richard Simmons, and when by the end of the book, I was just checking through like the infomercials of my life. By the way, I was like, yeah, I remember that. Oh yeah, I remember that. I remember that. And my mother-in-law was a jazzercise instructor, and so I'm like calling.
Really?
Yeah, Jeannie. Yeah.
And where was she an instructor?
In Ohio, in Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah.
Oh, and cool.
Yeah, so she was a labor and delivery nurse and also a jazzercise instructor.
I love that.
But no, and so I was checking with you earlier. My wife and I were kind of going through like that. Did your parents have the Thighmaster? Yes, they did. did you have and before we got to the end, before I got to the end of the book, I was like, you know, this is going through all, and my wife was like, it's going to end with the Peloton, and of course, yeah. it ends with
indeed.
The Peloton and all of our friends who have this very expensive either the excellent piece of exercise equipment that they love and, you know, compete with each other in this very fun way, or a very expensive place to like hang sweaters.
Well, there's something funny about lots of funny things about that, as you might imagine. I have thoughts, but one of the things that is interesting about like home exercise equipment and the difference between the Thighmaster and the Peloton, one of course is like the price point, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Peloton is just like $2,500, probably more now. The Thighmaster was not. It was like,
you don't want to know how much the Peloton costs in Australia, which is why I don't have one. Otherwise,
oh my God.
In COVID, I would have definitely, because it launched in Australia during COVID and I was very close to hitting the button, but it was like, is $5,000 too much to spend? And you're like, yes, it is.
Yes. Yeah. Oh gosh. But one of the things that's so funny is that home exercise equipment used to be sold very much as something you could easily hide away. Like the reason that you would have it in your home, but like you didn't want anyone to know you have like an ab roller or a Thighmaster. Like that's embarrassing that like, you know, you have a body that you need to work on and you would spend time doing that. And that goes way back maybe before the Thighmaster to like Charles Atlas and selling his dynamic tension programs. He's like, you can discreetly do this in your home. But by now, Peloton, Ergata, like all of these different kinds of workout equipment, they're like furniture, designer furniture. It's like things people want to show off. It's a status item. And that was so interesting to track, like in the 90s, when you started to see home gyms being built and people like the fancy thing was not to have a membership at some elite big sports club. It was to have your own home gym and personal trainer. So it's a piece of that like privatization narrative that we talk about of like, you don't even go to the private gym anymore. You build a private gym at your house, right?
Yeah, and it's part of that process of self-actualization as well, because, you know, you can ride on your Peloton and pretend you're in Paris, or you can ride on your Peloton and pretend you're, you know.
You can also, you know, I like not to like hit it too hard with the privatization narrative, because obviously that lends itself very easily to the kind of like neoliberalism talk, but there are like people exercised at home because they have disabilities, because they have caregiving responsibilities, because, I mean, a very popular one is like because they have bodies that even if they're not disabled, they feel uncomfortable showing up in, you know, spaces that can be very unwelcoming. So I tried to like bring all of that into because I think very often, like if you remember before the pandemic, like the Peloton was like, ha ha, it was a punchline of like the most privileged people have a freaking $2,500 or $5,000 exercise bike in their homes. During the pandemic, it was like a lifeline, you know, and it kind of changed its image a bit.
Yeah. Your final chapter, it was really interesting, and it was vibing with me in some weird ways because the experience of the pandemic in Australia was so different because we had a lockdown regime where they locked down the country. And so no one was allowed in. And then in Sydney, we were locked down by area. But one of the things that you could actually do, like you couldn't for about a few months, you couldn't go out and meet up with them except for exercising. That was the only way you could meet people because you could exercise outside in groups of four or something like that. And so everyone all of a sudden was exercising because it was the only way. So you'd go out to the park with someone and you're having lunch and the police would come by and you'd start doing push-ups. You know, like,
are you serious? If people really do, I knew that that was the rule, but is that the way
it, like, I think realistically speaking, it was, you know, and there's a whole politics of this. I mean, and in some ways lines up really well with your book about who could exercise and who was allowed to exercise, like, you know, so-called Sydney Westies or people who are clearly not Anglo, as they would say in Australia, which is to say kind of WASPy or Italian, Italian Catholic, would have a lot more trouble exercising. Like the police wouldn't believe them. Whereas like if I was out, you know, taking a walk with a buddy of mine and we had a beer, oh, well, it's a walk, you know, we're exercising.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I want to actually see that policy because that's amazing. Talk about the Fit Nation. Talk about a way of like encoding exercise into your actual law. That's amazing. I mean, I'm not like a huge fan of lockdown policy, but great carve out. What'd you say?
The other parts weren't actually that fun, like not being able to go out in other ways, but like...
It's horrible.
Yeah.
I'm not celebrating that at all. I'm not celebrating that at all. As you tell, as you see in the latter part of the book, I'm like, was very critical about much more moderate lockdown policies in the United States than in Australia about their implications for physical fitness. And I think that was, so, you know, I was really sad that the pandemic, well, I was sad about the pandemic for many reasons, but I was sad that the pandemic delayed my completion of this book because, you know, I have kids and all the rest. But I will say I am so grateful that I had the chance to conclude this book during and after the pandemic, because it was the discourse around public health was so illuminating of so many things, like just for those last chapters, but also earlier on. And I found it so interesting that, like, you know, the kind of like COVID maximalists, like, had a version, ironically, even though public health is supposed to be expansive, had a rather narrow vision of what health was. Like, it's about disease, COVID transmission prevention, and like that is all we care about. And it's like, well, what about like socializing, and what about coming together, and what about running, and what about all these things? It sounds like in Australia they at least realized like the exercise was a piece of it, but that's not it. And so that was just so interesting to witness.
We had we could talk about this for a long time. We had a very low incidence of public transmission, so we had this lockdown at a time when there were they started the lockdown at a time when we had in Sydney hundreds of cases, like not thousands, not tens of thousands, and so we just had the complete lockdown. And we actually went through a number of these. Melbourne was much worse, but that was the big argument. And in the end of your book shows it too, in the ways in which, you know, the Fit Nation, or I always wanted to call it Fit Nations, but because it's so many different groups, but the Fit Nation did get kind of bifurcated along these political lines in a way that was much less apparent was much less visible in some ways in the earlier periods, where, you know, conservatives, you know, oral people at Oral Roberts could have, you know, things in common with you know, people putting together stuff at a Salem, you know, and then
and then that shifts, right?
Yeah, it feels a lot more separated. Look, I know we have an out year coming up soon, so I wanted to give you a little time, Natalia, too, to tell us. This is maybe an unfair question because I know this book is not old, right? It just came out and it's coming out again in paperback. I'll mention that again at the end, but
thank you.
I wanted to give you a little time to tell us a bit about what you might be working on now as well. So what projects do you have going?
Absolutely. So I'm working on a new book proposal with my dear friend Neil J. Young, who I've had a podcast with for years, past, present. We're working on a book that's a history of the Hamptons, the region of New York, which is like known the world over as a luxurious destination. And it is that. And we are talking about the way that image was constructed, but we're also looking at like a story of like infrastructure and politics and demographic change that characterizes that region, and I think is applicable to and I think it's applicable to a lot of other communities. So I'm working on that. I have two actually documentary projects, which we'll see what happens, like film documentaries going on that are like built based on aspects of Fit Nation. My experience with Hollywood so far is like, don't believe it until you're like pressing your remote and it's on the TV. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, I'm working on that. I got another couple podcasts in the works. I know this is really annoying because I can't tell you what they are. But yeah. I can't share yet what they are, but one is related to a kind of also like a fitness related story. The other one is totally different and it's kind of in the realm of Jewish studies, which is something that I'm interested in, new to me. So hopefully I'll be able to come back on to maybe talk about the book and share more about this in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, that'd be great. All right. So thank you all for listening. You've been listening to the New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. I've been speaking today with Natalia Melman Petrozella, who is an associate professor of history at the New School and is the author of two books, but we've been talking today about Fit Nation, The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession. It's out with University of Chicago Press. It came out in 2022, but you couldn't get it until 2023, but now you can get it in hardback. And in April, you can get it in paperback. So, and also on you can get an audiobook as well. It's in all formats. Natalia is also the author of an earlier book, Classroom Wars, Language, Sex, and the Making of Modern Political Culture with Oxford University Press. Natalia, thank you so much for joining me today. And it's really been a pleasure to speak with you.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I am a senior lecturer here at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Thank you all very much for listening.